Please welcome Dr. Nikolai Vitti, Lori Higgins, and Young Leader Board Member Lexi Cirilli.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lexi Cirilli, and I am an account manager with Tanner Friedman and also a Detroit Economic Club Young Leader Board member. And it's my pleasure to introduce our next session. As a change agent for children, Dr. Nikolai Vitti's decades of expertise led to his appointment as the new superintendent of Detroit Public Schools Community District. He took the reins of this important office of May of this year. Dr. Vitti understands the importance of high student achievement and has proven solutions to problems that have plagued public education in Detroit. He spent his first 100 days engaging many community stakeholder groups through listen and learn sessions, a significant central office reorganization, and is now re-embarking on laying the foundation for the district's strategic plan. A native of Metro Detroit, Dr. Vitti previously led Duval County Public Schools in Jacksonville, Florida, and prior to that worked at Miami-Dade County Public Schools as Chief Academic Officer. Dr. Vitti received the prestigious Presidential Scholarship from the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and in 2012, he completed his doctorate from Harvard in Education, Administration, Planning, and Social Policy. So quite the resume there. Our moderator for this session is Lori Higgins, the education reporter at the Detroit Free Press. Lori has been an education reporter for more than 20 years, much of that time spent at the Free Press, where she currently covers the Detroit Public Schools Community District, suburban schools, state education issues, and trends in education. She is a native of Chicago and frequently draws on her own experience attending schools in the troubled Chicago Public Schools District, and being the daughter and niece of Chicago teachers and trying to understand the problems that afflict urban schools. And with that, please, Lori, take it away.
Thank you. Okay, so, so we're gonna start by talking a little bit about leadership and how you define leadership, but I first wanna have you talk about the transformation that you're that's underway in the district. Anyone who's read the headlines about DPS, DPSCD, knows about the dysfunction in the district and over the last decade or so. And tell me a little bit about how you are going about changing that.
First of all, thank you for having me. Hopefully you gained something from this session, not only about my experience as a leader, but also where we are in DPSCD and in the rebuilding process. So for me, the entry process was truly about listening from stakeholders internally and externally. The district has gone through a lot of change. Most of that has not necessarily been positive. When you look at change in the form of inputs leading to better outputs. So it was important coming in to really understand how internal and external stakeholders saw where the district stood. So I didn't make assumptions coming in, but could do a clear SWOT analysis, determining strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, and then applying my skill set in my experience in transforming large urban school districts or organization. So there could be a better connection between what I assumed was the problem and having a clear blueprint of how to transform systems, but applying that to a set of circumstances that were unique and articulated by those that would feel the change that would be coming through my leadership.
Give people a sense of what challenges you faced. I mean, what was the situation like when you got here? I mean, you've talked a lot about the lack of systems in the district.
Well, I think for context, it's important for those in the audience to understand that the district over the past decade has essentially been operated or controlled through the state, through Lansing, particularly the governor's office. where most school districts are run by an elected school board, varying from sometimes as many as 9 to 7 to 5, voted by individual citizens at the local level, and then they appoint a superintendent as the CEO to run the organization. In Detroit, over a decade, the elected board was disempowered, so they did not pick the leader of the district. The district leader instead was called an emergency manager, and this was someone appointed directly by the governor, who had ultimate power to implement the change that he saw fit, he being, because all were males, to do what was needed to transform the district. Unfortunately, that individual was not an educational leader, often a political appointment or a bureaucrat, not really positioned with the right experience and skill set to transform the school district. So coming in as the first appointed superintendent in over a decade with an empowered board for the first time, my entry has been one of discovery of the lack of systems and processes for just about everything. You would think that an emergency manager would, at the minimum, if not in raising student achievement, would ensure systems were in place to do all the operational things that theoretically emergency manager would be able to do, or someone with ultimate authority would be able to do, but that was not the case. So coming in, we've had to immediately try to build systems to purchase textbooks, determine inventory of textbooks, hire teachers, process the hiring of teachers, make sure teachers are paid on time. All of the things that we take for granted in large organizations functionally were not happening at scale and consistency. So one of the first steps has been to try to restore functionality in just a normal operating system.
So what, given what you've said about the previous emergency managers, what do you feel you bring to the table? I mean, why should people have confidence that you can turn these things around?
Well, I think, one, local control is important. For many Detroiters, the belief was that reform was imposed on the citizens of Detroit. In fact, the citizens of Detroit voted against emergency management, but was ignored by the governor's authority based on statute. So what I've been able to bring to Detroit at this point is, one, it starts with an elected board that went through a national search process to pick what they believed would be the most seasoned, experienced superintendent that had a track record of improving larger urban school districts. So what I believe I bring, which is different, is accountability as it's connected to an elected, empowered school board, and a track record of raising student achievement from as a former teacher, a principal leader, chief academic officer, and as superintendent in some of the larger districts in the country, from New York to Jacksonville in Miami, and even working at the state level in Florida. So I bring with me experience and a track record of reform that has not necessarily been seen in Detroit for over a decade.
You've talked a lot about how you want Detroit to be the best urban district in the nation, but how do you manage your expectations? Because there's that danger of people expecting too much too soon. So how do you manage that?
Well, I do think it's important to function with a sense of urgency and to offer to the community a sense of urgency, because ultimately we're talking about children's lives. And we're talking about the fact that the public education system, for many of our children, is the vehicle for equal opportunity and social justice. And so to talk about excuses as to why it's not going to happen immediately is just not acceptable. So a good case in point is, in starting as superintendent going into this summer, we had 425 vacancies. And I made it very clear that our expectation was to be fully staffed on the first day of school. And people said, why in the world would you say that when the district the year previously only recruited 30 teachers from January to the end of the year? And I said, how could I possibly give a number that was greater than zero when we're talking about the reality that every child deserved a fully certified teacher the first day of school? And so that to me is about leadership and having the right expectations of what children deserve and pushing the system to meet those expectations. So although we weren't fully staffed at the beginning of the year, we had 250 vacancies, which were fewer than 425, but also fewer than the year previous when the district started with 276 and had 11 fewer schools and 250 fewer teachers to actually hire. And today we're at 194 vacancies, and so that number continues to whittle down because we're pushing the system to be accountable for what children need. But it is a rebuilding process. The system at one time over 20 years ago was considered one of the best urban school districts in the country. So if it's taken 20 years for it to deteriorate, then common sense would tell you it can't be rebuilt in a year. But with a sense of urgency, with a clear strategic plan in place, with the opportunity to hire the right people, which I have been able to do over the past couple of months, I do believe we will quickly rebuild the system, but also manage expectations that it will take time to restore the strength of the school system at the point that it once was at.
So you talked about the teacher shortages, but what would you say has been your biggest leadership challenge so far?
Multiple. I would say trying to manage the school system and transform it at the same time. So we talk about the teacher vacancies. In my mind, we want to be able to begin to train teachers on the Common Core standards and what that looks like in the classroom, to start to go through the identification of new material so that students are engaged more rigorously and in a way that's more engaging to what their needs are. But before we can do that, or to create residency programs with local universities or historically black colleges throughout the country to bring more diverse teachers to Detroit. But I can't do that until we fill vacancies. And so it's at times challenging as a leader to recognize that it all can't be done at once, and you have to build a foundation first, get the basics down, and then move more into innovation and reform. And I think that's the greatest challenge. The other challenge is trying to overcome bad overall, I wouldn't say bad, I would say trying to overcome compliance, a culture of compliance, a culture of complacency, and also a culture of the status quo. What has happened in Detroit over the last 10 years is that principals, teachers, district staff have learned to survive. And so when you are in survival mode, you try to avoid innovation because you don't want to be penalized for doing something differently or acting as if you're better than everyone else. And at the same time, you try to at least stay in compliance. So basically, you just function day to day to stay off the radar. That's the last thing children at scale who are growing up in poverty need. And so it's trying to shock the system to wake people up to what children can do at scale, to do things differently, but at the same time keep people together so they don't abandon the system because they're fearful of the change. So that's all part of the challenge of running a system, rebuilding it, but also being very true and respectful of the scars that have taken place, the scars that are clear, based on years of negative leadership in the district.
Okay. Speaking of leadership, you've worked with some of the top superintendents, yes, in the country, in New York and Miami. Can you talk a little bit about what you've learned from those superintendents and how that sort of helped you become a better leader?
Well, I would say that I have been fortunate to be in some of the best leadership programs in the country. Harvard's Graduate School of Education, Urban Superintendents Program in particular, and even when I became a teacher, I was able to learn from others in a very strategic, thoughtful, reflective way, and I think we've lost sight of that. So too many of our teachers are simply thrown into the classroom, and they learn how to teach through survival. Many of our principals are put in the toughest schools throughout this country, and then they learn how to lead just by doing. I was fortunate to be in programs all focused on the urban core, but I was given an opportunity to learn through a mentor, I was able to teach before I was held accountable for teaching. I was able to learn how to be a superintendent by modeling and shadowing one of the best superintendents in the country. I've been on the cabinet of 3 National Superintendents of the Year. So all those experiences allow me to learn who I am and who I'm not. But also, in shadowing experiences, I've been able to see what the work looks like without being accountable to actually doing the work. And that's something that I've always tried to instill in the districts I've run, which are clear residency programs, job shadowing opportunities, so that our teachers, future leaders, learn how to become teachers and leaders before being accountable to actually making sure that children are learning. And with shortages, with the lack of funding, with the lack of belief and confidence in public education, we've functioned by emergency. We have functioned by survival rather than thoughtfulness. So the same thing that you apply to the residency program for future doctors is really what we should be doing for teachers and leaders in education, so you learn by doing. So what have I learned from those leaders? I've learned that you need a vision. So systems often in public education in particular will often just go about their day-to-day work serving children, not necessarily with a vision in mind, because you're working with children, you're serving children. There's a level of day-to-day work that's accepted without innovation and reform and higher expectations and even results. The leaders I've been able to work with have a vision of what children can do and what systems can do without people necessarily believing that it can happen or even seeing it. All the superintendents, I've learned strategy, that you can have a vision, but without a concrete strategy and a clarity regarding initiatives and strategies that drive that vision, then it's just hyperbole, it's just rhetoric. Without actual concrete plans. All the superintendents I've been able to work with measure what that looks like. So vision, strategy, measurement, and actually project managing the things that you say you're going to do. So you're thinking inputs, but coupled with outputs. For many of you in the business sector, that's commonplace. In education, that is not at scale. So I've been able to work with leaders that are very intentional about the implementation of a vision and in measuring and holding people accountable in doing that. And that sometimes means making difficult personnel changes. It's shocking systems and changing leaders even when people have been there for a long time. And it means accelerating promotions and opportunities for individuals that may not have the experience but have demonstrated a skill set to get things done rather quickly and at scale. And then that's the last piece that I would certainly talk about, is at-scale reform. It's not about changing one school or one classroom, but it's at-scale reform, thinking about systems and processes to impact thousands of children. Not thinking about, again, one school of 1,000 kids, but thinking about scale as it relates to 60,000 children, 120,000 children, or even 1 million children in some of the largest school districts in the country. And many of those things are foreign, believe it or not, in public school systems.
Okay. You touched on this a little bit. I'm curious, you've had to make a lot of quick decisions in the first few months, including the reorganization of the central office mm-hmm. staff. And how do you assess people that quickly in order to make decisions about who will be the best fit for your administration?
It's always difficult. I think personnel changes, if anyone enjoys laying people off or going through restructuring and they don't see the human challenge of doing that, then I question why you're a leader. Because there has to be always a human element of leadership, but at the same time, you have to have the courage and vision to make those decisions at the same time. And that is also foreign in public education. Immediately coming in, the first thing that I analyzed were org charts. And for some of you, that might be exciting. For me, who's a nerd when it comes to these things, I love org charts because org charts reflect the vision of what an organization or people in it should be doing in order to create results. And one, we didn't necessarily have org charts across the district, so that was the first sign that there was a problem. And then once I started to study those org charts, I immediately met with people and started to ask questions. What do you do? If you had the chance to do anything differently, what would you do? What are the obstacles in what you do every day? And could there be an articulation of a vision beyond what they do every day? And from that allowed me, especially at the cabinet levels and going into number twos and threes, I started to see quickly who had a vision for doing things differently, who was a problem solver, who felt restrained from the system, or who just showed up to work every day. I also started to see that duplication in what people did. So when there wasn't clarity on an org chart why one person was above the other, and they sounded like they did the same thing, that was an immediate opportunity to reduce a position. So in only a couple of weeks, maybe a month's time, I was able to put back $7 million back into schools by eliminating positions. And that now will be used for program generation at schools in areas like arts, music, robotics, STEM, coding. In addition to that, more training for teachers on the new set of standards and an infusion in technology in our schools, which are desperately needed. I was able to do that by acting quickly. I was able to do that with a sense of urgency, but I was also able to do that because I had done that work before. And so when you do that work, you're able to ask questions and detect what's really going on fairly quickly rather than learning the process and people for the first time.
So you were able to recruit about a handful or more of people from Florida that you worked with there, people who left their jobs and lives and maybe even family members to come here. What do you think it is about you as a leader that these folks were willing to do that, to relocate here?
I don't know what it's like always in the private sector, but in the realm of public education, there are few leaders that truly are visionary and function with a sense of urgency where they truly put children first. Not, and I wouldn't say adults second, but they put children at the center of what they're trying to do. And there, in every sector, there are innovative leaders. There are people that wake up every day hungry for results, especially in our body of work when it's linked to children. But often they're in the minority as far as trendsetters. And so those small groups of people gravitate towards those who will allow them the flexibility and freedom to actually implement at-scale change. So I was able to recruit individuals that I worked with previously, whether it be Jacksonville, Miami, Florida in general. And I was also able to recruit a lot of Detroiters that were working for the district outside of the district, but for the first time was willing to go into the school district because they felt that the time was now to change the system, but also they felt that they would be empowered to actually implement the change that they wanted to implement for a long time and were doing on the periphery rather inside the system. So I think people were just inspired by the vision, but more importantly, believed that they could actually be themselves as reformers within the system and to create change that was actionable. And there are a few opportunities to do that, and they just felt that the opportunity was now to do that. And then the other component of all that was the story and opportunity of Detroit. I think when you look at how far we have to go, Detroit is probably the best example of the gap that exists between where results are and where results should be. So the opportunity gap is enormous in Detroit, and a lot of the individuals that have come with me or were from Detroit that are going back or going into the system are driven by opportunity and driven by the challenge and opportunity of large urban school districts. But no challenge is quite as profound and great as Detroit. So they're motivated for change anywhere in this country, but the opportunity is best defined in Detroit nationally. So that just serves as a great magnet for talent, especially talented people that want to do at-scale reform in large urban setting.
So I want to ask you about work-life balance, because I'm pretty sure you don't sleep. I've gotten emails from you in the middle of the night on more than one occasion. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about how do you balance your own expectations for yourself versus what you expect of your leadership team?
Great question. So some of you may know, I've been married for over 16 years. I have four children, the oldest being 14, the youngest 8, three boys and a girl. I really can't say that I have a life outside of work and family. And I'm actually proud of that. I grew up in a broken home. My father left when I was young. My mother raised me by myself. But to be able to say that I've been married as long as I have and raise and be an active father for 14 years is something that speaks to balance, meaning I work awful hard. I work long hours. But when I'm home, I really try to be home for my kids, and my kids know me. My kids will tell, if I left and they were brought in, they would say that I'm an active, engaged father. And I do believe my wife would say that I'm an active, engaged husband and partner. So that balance also comes from the fact that my wife is also my best friend. And she and I actively talk about this work constantly. So that allows me to be me, but it's her. So I can take my work at home. Some people completely separate that. I can't, but that's how we work, and it makes me better, it makes her better. So that's where the balance isn't quite there, but it is there, if that makes sense. We also involve our children in our work. So this work isn't really work, it's a passion. I'm driven by equity, social justice, and opportunity. So when I go to work every day, it's who I am, it's who my wife is, it's who our kids are. They're involved in it, they come to events, we talk about these issues at home, whether they're issues of class, race, opportunity, politics. So there's a blend between work and home, and I think that's where the balance actually comes, in knowing that your family is your family and they're going to accept you and believe in you no matter the mistakes you make. But I wouldn't say that there's necessarily balance. I guess that's what I'm getting at. I've learned that there's a place to eating right. There's a place for exercising. And I think that has made me a better leader and a better person. I would always advocate for that. But my work is my passion. My work is my identity. And I'm proud of that, and I'm unapologetic about it.
Okay, so I guess that's a good time to wrap up here.
Yes. A lot of audience questions here. So we'll start off. A lot of young professionals, is this on? A lot of young professionals in the room are starting families, moving to the city of Detroit. So what are your efforts to attract and retain these families to send their kids to DPS rather than charter schools?
Yeah, thank you for the question. My four children are in DPSED. And I believe that if you search the current system enough, you will find high-performing schools that rival charter schools and even rival private schools. You have to look right now. It's not going to be in front of you. And it depends probably where you live and where you're interested in sending your children. But there are schools in the system right now that are college-going cultures and can prepare children for college and work opportunities after that. I will make the plug, and I will say that I believe that traditional public education is a microcosm of the real world. And if you're serious about raising children that will be future leaders, they have to learn how to interact with people that are different than they are. Different than them, they are as far as race, ethnicity, language, and I will say most importantly, socioeconomic background. Somewhere along the line, we believe that by protecting our children and isolating our children, and somehow we're benefiting them, and we're not. Because as they go off in college, and they more importantly go out in the real world, they're no longer isolated and secluded. There are certain elements of that, but if you're really going to be a leader, which I think we all want our children to be leaders, you have to be able to connect, empathize, and sympathize with those that are different than you. And I think public education offers the best venue for that to happen. Moving forward, My plan is to build accelerated programs in every corner of the district so that you can have those schools that I said exist and you have to search for them. They should be in every zip code throughout Detroit. They should be in every quadrant of Detroit so that you don't have to search, but you can find them immediately, and that the programming is unique and diverse so that if your child is really interested in the arts, they can go to school Y. But if they're really interested in coding, they can go to Z. If they're really interested in zoology, then they can go to school F. But the vision is to create such a nuance and uniqueness that you are literally opting into a school that meets the needs of your child and that your child is going to be most excited about after that core knowledge is built in any school throughout Detroit.
Great, thank you. I know a lot of folks in the room want to get your thoughts on standardized testing.
Sure. So I believe it or not, I do believe in standardized testing. I believe in measurement. It goes back to my points earlier. But I do believe the pendulum has swung too far where everything now is reduced to a standardized test. So when I started as a teacher in New York City, there was no standardized testing. It was right before No Child Left Behind. And I was angry when I would go to work every day and I would have my children work bell to bell, be pushing them constantly, and they would go to a class next door and nothing was going on, and nothing was holding that teacher accountable to making sure that children were learning every day. So that's when I became a proponent of standardized testing, because I felt like there would be a level of accountability to actually measure that children were learning and that teachers were going to be accountable for that. I still believe in that at some level. But what has happened now is school systems have gutted art programs, music programs, PE programs, electives in general. That curriculum has been reduced to, is the answer A, B, C, or D, not do you agree or disagree and explain your answer in writing. So in other words, we've walked away from critical thinking and problem solving to answering a bubble question, you know, taking a bubble test. That's not thinking, that's not learning, that's not developing a generation of leaders. So we need to find, the pendulum has to go somewhere in the middle where we're measuring, but we're improving the way we measure, and we're using other forms of measurement other than just a standardized test. Because we also know, and research clearly defines this, that there is also a bias inherent in standardized testing. And it doesn't necessarily measure intelligence. It measures the ability to answer questions well in a standardized form. But it doesn't necessarily measure your ability to problem solve, think out of the box, and lead people. So we need a balance, but I think it's gone too far. And there's a way to create balance, I think, in the right accountability system.
So piggybacking off of that, can you talk about the other forms of measurement that you plan
sure.
on using?
Yeah, so one form of measurement that I'm an advocate of is portfolios. And so I'm not talking about portfolios that just, you know, you take worksheets that you did and you put it in a folder and you say, look, the child learned the benchmark because of a worksheet. What I'm talking about is, for example, the evolution of writing, is that you start a year off writing something or a sample of a written product, and then throughout the year you see how that sample writing, not on that same topic, but other topics have evolved, where you see the improvement of vocabulary usage, the description of concepts explained, arguments refined. I also believe in oral exams. I think, you know, America doesn't get everything right, and I think Europe in some ways gets this part right, where they rely more on oral examinations, where you actually have to stand up in front of teachers and professors and explain answers. I think that's actually harder than guessing whether it's A, B, or C, or D. There's nowhere to hide if you can't answer the question. And it also builds oral skills and confidence in speaking and articulating words and forming words and ideas. So the better form is some level of standardization, but portfolio and oral exams, I think, are better examples of performance-based tasks rather than just standardization.
Great. What are you doing to attract young leaders in positions within DPS?
So I think, and although I, for some of you, I may look much older than 40, I think the fact that I'm young attracts young leaders. So I think when individuals either hear me speak or lead, it gives them motivation to go into a system that historically has been driven by experience only, not necessarily skill set and results. So I think that is naturally leading young people to gravitate toward Detroit. I also think that people will start to see that individuals will be promoted and that there's clear succession management. That's another component that I've learned from former leaders is succession management, which public school systems have historically not done well. But when people see themselves promoted much faster based on skill set and results, not because they've been an assistant principal for 5 years and then become eligible to be the principal, or they become the department chair after only 3 years rather than 5 years. I think experience matters. I don't want to discount that, but we shouldn't put years of experience connected to when you can have an opportunity to take more responsibility for children's growth and progress. And so I think that will attract younger leaders to enter the system. I also believe that as we move into more performance-based accountability, and I think when we move more into clear examples of innovation and reform, that will also inspire young people to join the school system.
Great. Well, that's a wrap on this session. So Dr. Vitti and Lori, thank you for being here with us today.